We're back to finish off our review of the Undercover album.
My favorite Stones album of all time.
In case you've forgotten, we're your hosts, Natalie and Gina, Gavin and McLeod, the recently deceased Gavin McLeod.
Poor Gavin McLeod.
I think he was 100. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I mean, he was on the Love Boat, and he probably was only 47.
A lot of people just know him as Captain. He was a mentor to so many actors. I mean, he was really heavyweight.
I didn't know that about him at all.
Oh, yeah.
They learn something every day.
That's a separate podcast. Yeah, really.
That's the Love Boat podcast that we might start one day. We might not. Who knows? But today we're talking more about Undercover, and we're going to start with Pretty Beat Up.
Wow. To me, like, what drugs can even account for this? This isn't your normal anything. This is like maybe peyote, something that's a different culture.
I would call it a groove tune, and when we look at how it was structured and who put it together, I think the only song on here on Undercover with a Ronnie songwriting credit, and Ronnie writes these groove tunes, and they're all great. You can go back to Hey Negrita, you can go back to Dance.
Sure.
I mean, the stuff from his solo albums a lot of times are like this. Like, Ronnie is a great groove guitar player and a great groove songwriter.
Indisputably, there's a lot of different musics colliding in the Atom Smasher here, and it's all wonderful, but it's the ineffable strangeness of this to me is like it's the Stones playing the Black Lodge.
Wow.
Like, if you're there, you know, for that scene, like, give me my garbosia, you know, the next room is the Stones playing this song. There's something so messed up about the time elements and things. It's amazing. But you've got country, you've got funk, you have this amazing 80s sax.
Which is not Bobby Keys, but David Sanborn, who was hot in the 80s sax world, I think.
No, for sure.
I mean, this is going back a ways, and I don't know that I owned his album or anything like that, but I just remember he shows up in a lot of the history when you look these things up.
He was there, man.
I mean, the Stones, it's interesting because they already had possibly the greatest rock and roll sax player of all time as their house sax player. And yet, that's not good enough. Like, you know, once in a while you get other guys who are also terrific who show up. Sonny Rollins.
Oh, sure.
On Tattoo U. And then you get David Sanborn here who really, I mean, it's not a long solo, but it's terrific.
You know, I'd play no brass instruments at all, but it's something I remember.
Yeah.
Usually I'm concentrating on the riffs and stuff. In terms of that, like, in many ways you can hear maybe a Mutant, you know, version of Turd on the Run.
Yeah.
When you sit down and, you know, get your guitar out and play, you're like, oh, wait, yeah, this is familiar. Sure. There are some people who are still trying to flog the horse, because we talked about this before, right? The Lowell Fulsom connection. People are saying, well, this song is also Tramp.
Mm.
Like, there's a little bit of that groove, but yeah, where did he get it from? Well, he got it from Junior Walker,
yeah.
Right? 10 years earlier, messing with a kid. And where did Junior Walker get it from? Like, well, some Afro-Cuban beats he was tuning into and probably cycled through Ray Charles, Louis Jordan, you know? I mean, when you're going that way. But to try to, like, well, those Stones, they're copying American black music. That's their reason for being.
That's what started them out.
That's like what they do. And they do it so great in so many genres. I don't know that you can say, like, well, the Stones reached a creative bottom because they borrowed from the great Lowell Fulsom, you know, like...
It's all in the name.
That's what I want.
Right, exactly.
To me, I want to say mixed vocals, I think, on this really are like beyond the pale.
Yeah, they're really good. He doesn't get...
we might make a spin-off podcast called Mick Doesn't Get Enough Credit.
He's the greatest frontman of all time and yet still doesn't get enough credit for all these other things he does.
He's not even getting enough credit as, you know, the front man. The greatest front man of all time.
Of the greatest band of all time. Even that, he doesn't get enough credit for that. But I think there was maybe some early reviews and criticisms like, well, he's not really a singer. He's an imitator. He's a British guy from middle class background imitating Muddy Waters, imitating Howlin' Wolf. I think at this point, he's a singer. He's not an imitator. He's an imitator and a singer.
Right, and I think as an imitator, he doesn't get it. Just for fun,
right?
Like goofing around, with anyone, he doesn't get enough credit as an imitator. But I mean, here he has these shouts, he's got these sneers, these whoops, these special unique accents that are, you know, curiously only from Mick. Maybe this is like a Lightning Hopkins. he's got a twang. He's got a lot happening, and it's great.
Whenever anyone else, and I'll put myself in this, but whenever anyone else tries to do it, you really can't. He can imitate anybody, but you can't imitate him really without it. It just doesn't work. There's been many people who've tried it, and it doesn't sound right. And it's,
if you could guess who he was imitating, that would give you, and try to imitate them, that would give you a leg up on it. But you still wouldn't get there.
It's the strangest thing, because he's a guy who is British. And yet speaks like a guy who's doing a fake British accent sometimes. And I think that comes off in his singing. Ronnie plays it live, or has played it live. I've seen set lists where whoever he's playing with has covered it. They didn't tour with Undercover. I feel like if they had toured around this time, this would have been a great one to have. Late set, perhaps, when he's as a jam session or something. Something like the way Slave might have been on Tattoo U.
Maybe. Again, to me, there's something eerie about this track. Like, if you drank too much, you would be, you'd be worried, like, you know, Frank Booth was going to walk in huffing something any second, you know, but it's groovy and it's a little menacing to me at the same time, which is what you want, really.
There's a note that, in the credits, that Bill is on Yamaha electric piano, but depending on what version you listen to, it's not always that easy to hear. I think it's, you know, sometimes you have a record player or a stereo back in the day that didn't work right, and maybe you lose a channel or you lose a speaker, and then you're hearing it. But
yeah, your cassette in your car, half the right channel's gone out.
One other thing I'll note about this is the title, Pretty Beat Up. I think I've seen things that this had a different title in other spots. I'm not sure. Sometimes I think they're conflating different outtakes with different titles, but fits again in the theme, overall theme of the album, which is a lot about violence.
Well, I mean, it's a violent world.
Yeah.
The Stones aren't injecting their violence into the world. I think they're reflecting what we're all living with.
The next song on the album is Too Tough. Dates back to 1975, maybe. I've seen that number, probably other mid-70s. I think I've seen it called, this might have been called Cellophane Trousers at one time. But that, again, like sometimes I'll see a list and it's got a different title and then it's a different song. So to me, this sounded like something that could have been, even though it dates back to the 70s, could have ended up on like an Emotional Rescue or something. Built on a Keith riff to start out with. Kind of another spin on Jumpin' Jack Flash, maybe.
Sure.
I found some things on some other boards that said this might have been a final single off the album. I didn't put too much stock into that because it had already been a B-side. One thing about this, though, I think there's one point in particular where Mick seems to have trouble with some of the high notes on this song.
It's interesting. You know, to me, this sounds like a Mick solo or the precursor to a Mick Jagger solo album. I think the thing is because he's shouting most of the...
Yeah.
Most of the lyrics, it's
like his vocals are a little muddy, and then there's a point when they get right to the chorus. This is when it comes to a fight, you want to play it rough, and there's some high notes in there that I don't know if they didn't like. Well, listen, we don't have time to go back and correct that now. Far be it from me to criticize, but it just seemed like he's aiming for a couple of things that he doesn't quite hit. But maybe that's just it. Maybe like, well, no, this is the mood we were going for on this type of thing.
Or maybe you could have sung those notes, but you can't shout those notes. That's a different thing. Was Mick inventing death metal?
Wow.
That vocal style. I don't know. Something particularly in this song, I think the way the drums come in on the chorus, it's almost like this would be done and overdone to death in the 90s, but you have this really heavy, like, wow. It almost made me think, like, is this like Street Fighting Man? Is this just Charlie or is someone helping with some timpani? But no, it's just Charlie like beating the shit out of the kit.
The riff is very similar in a way to Jumpin' Jack Flash, just played at a different tempo. And you can make the argument like, well, we wrote six songs, but we just find new ways to reinterpret them in different ways. I speed the tempo up. I do it this way. I do it that way. I don't know how much of this would have come out of one of those jam sessions where Keith just starts like, well, I'm going to hit this riff a bunch of times and then we're going to see where we go with it. I've not seen anything that said like this was a Keith song that he was going to do and then, you know, gives it to Mick to sing. But I don't know. See, now you're saying that you saw it as more like a mixed solo thing. I thought, well, this is one I could kind of see Keith doing. Because it's very riff built, whereas in a way that like Pretty Beat Up or, you know, some of the other ones we've talked about aren't. But
you know, when you bring that up, this is another case for why this album is so strong, because there isn't just one kind of song on here.
Yeah.
You know, some songs are just like, well, this is all about the groove. This is all about the riff. This is all about the lyrics. You know, what band can do all that in the space of one album? Is Mick sticking up for Bill in the lyrics here?
How so? How do you think?
The lyric about, you know, I was married.
The teenage bride.
Yeah.
Well, this would have been before. They didn't get married for a few years after this. But I think if we look it up, maybe they were seeing each other. I don't want to even conjecture. I don't know what the backstory is on any of that.
If we're adding this to the list of the 50,000 things this week Mick didn't get enough credit for, you know, sticking up for Bill Wyman is probably in there somewhere.
They seem to have a strange relationship. I mean, we like Bill Wyman was always the older guy. He was the guy who, on one hand, did, you know, when it came to womanizing, I think his numbers are far ahead of anyone else's. I think he said that at one point in the early days, you know, Mick was the only guy who would talk to him, Mick and Ian Stewart, when he first joined. He said later on he was good friends with Brian Jones toward the end, because they used to go out to nightclubs and things. And he was very good friends with Charlie over the years. I've seen things where there's mention of him and Mick hanging out socially. Their wives were friends. They were models or whatever, and things like that. So socially seems to be one thing. Professionally seems to be something else from time to time. You know, around the time of Voodoo Lounge, after Bill left, they do a special for VH1. And they're asking Mick about it. And he's very dismissive. Like, it's not a hard job. I'll find someone else to do it. Keith, at the same time, was very like, yeah, we got a new guy. He's great. You know, if you don't want to do this 100%, then don't do it. I think in later times, they've come back around like, yeah, he was terrific. I don't know. It's hard to say. But if he was sticking up for him here.
Good.
Yeah, very good. I was married yesterday.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Hard Labor and Money Splashes, the podcast dedicated to the world's greatest rock and roll band, the Rolling Stones. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Email us at hardlabormoneysplashes@gmail.com.